loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. President Donald Trump has announced Neil Gorsuch as his pick for the vacant Supreme Court justice. Who is Gorsuch? The judge expected to follow in the ultra-right-wing footsteps of Antonin Scalia. What does Trump's choice say about the direction his administration is heading? What role Gorsuch can be expected to play in the court? Gorsuch's relatively young age means that he will be an important figure in the U.S. legal battles for decades to come. We are joined from Atlanta by Anoa Changa, an activist, lawyer, and the host of the weekly radio show, The Way with Anoa, as well as in studio by Professor Zachary Wolf, a lawyer, activist, and professor at George Washington University. And we are joined by Eugene Puryear, host of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary. Welcome, Anoa, Eugene, and Zach.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Wolf, was this a surprise?
It was not a surprise at all. He had been on the short list over the last week or so. He had been on the original list during the campaign. And this morning, there were leaked a number of op-eds and conservative papers that were advocating for him being the choice among the top choices. So it really was not a surprise at all that he was the final selection.
And talk about who Gorsuch is. I mean, of course, he's a Circuit Court of Appeals judge. He is a conservative. He said Antonin Scalia, whose seat he's taking, was a lion of the law. Wow. Who is Gorsuch?
Well, he's a conservative justice on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals currently. Really not a surprise. Certainly follows in the conservative tradition that Trump was looking for, that the people who celebrate Justice Scalia were looking for.
Anoa Changa, when we talk about conservative, is it simply sort of a code word for something else? I mean, Scalia, who Gorsuch said was a lion of the law, I want to read to you, Anoa, one of his comments based on a court case regarding affirmative action. He said, "There are those who contend that it does not benefit African Americans to get them into the University of Texas where they do not do well, as opposed to having them go to a less advanced school, a slower track school where they do well." I mean, wow, that's just straight out racism, no?
Well, I remember when this happened, you know, there was a lot of clapback to use the term from folks about what it meant to be at a slower paced school and things like that. Like just the coded language, and it's not even really code language. It is when you're talking about Black students and white students and where people go to school. Scalia had several moments, right, over the course of his career where it was very clear that he had certain particular ideas or conceptions of what it meant for people, particularly people of color, Black people, to exist, with whether we're talking about affirmative action, the criminal justice system, et cetera. And so when we say conservative, there is definitely a thought process or a certain way of engaging with the legal system that, whether it is direct or intentional, it definitely marginalizes experiences and opportunities for Black, Latino, others of color in general.
Eugene Puryear, I want to stay with Scalia because he went out of his way to praise Scalia. I mean, he said he missed him now that he's dead, the late lamented Judge Scalia. But he went out of his way to say he was a lion of the law. He also talked about Judge Jackson. That's how he actually started. Robert Jackson is one of his great heroes. Jackson, of course, presided over the Dennis versus the USA, the Smith Act trial that sent all of these socialists and communists to prison for long periods of time because they believed in Marxism. I mean, they couldn't prove any that they were carrying out illegal acts, but Judge Jackson said because of their ideas innately, the ideas of communism, and he cited works written by Marx 150 years earlier about revolution. On that basis, he could send these communists to jail. Now, if you have the new Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch, or the nominee, saying Judge Jackson is his hero and Scalia is a lion of the law, you would expect the liberals to stand up and do something in the Senate. But when I was just looking at CNN, Eugene, these guys were falling all over themselves. They said, oh, it couldn't have been a better way to roll out a Supreme Court nomination. I mean, it was like a review of The Apprentice TV show. But they were all about Gorsuch himself, meaning they're preparing the road for no real struggle, it seems to me. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good point, and I'll say two things about that. I mean, I one of the more ironic things is one of the things Justice Scalia said towards the end of his life. He was talking about diversity on the court, and he mentioned that they all had gone to Harvard and Yale, which is you know, continued here with Gorsuch. You know, he's considered to already be popular with Elena Kagan in particular, one of the liberal justices. People from his office clerks are often moved into the Supreme Court. So, I mean, you can see sort of the institutional power dynamic there. People say, you know, there is an elite, a ruling class, a 1% playing into this, which I think is an interesting factor. And thus, I think what's leading to the Democrats to do what they want to do. I think it's interesting to look at Gorsuch in the most conventional sense. And I think one thing we haven't mentioned is he's also a big champion of limiting the ability of the government to regulate corporations, as well as having at least intimated towards a very extreme view towards campaign finance donations that could be deeper than Citizens United. But also, if you look at his book about euthanasia, you know, it's not all about the founders and originalism. I mean, you know, it's about Christianity and whatever. Some of it is about the founders and moral and political. And it actually reminds me to a large degree of Steve Bannon and that sort of broader traditionalist, Christian-centered, right-wing worldview that he seems to be, along with Jeff Sessions, sort of cultivating. I mean, it's a softer face and a very seductive package, given that, you know, he's a writer and some intellectual to some degree, but similar sort of DNA. And I thought that was also sort of an interesting fact to reflect on.
Eugene, I want to just stay with you for a quick second before I bring Professor Wolf back in. In the New Yorker magazine, Amy Davidson wrote a piece in 2013 about Scalia. And I want to read to you, Eugene, her words. Justice Antonin Scalia, during oral arguments at the Supreme Court on Wednesday, said the court had to rescue Congress from the trap of being afraid to vote against a, quote, racial entitlement. The, quote, entitlement in question being the Voting Rights Act. Even the name of it is wonderful, the Voting Rights Act. Who is going to vote against that in the future? This is Scalia. Scalia said that not alone, but it appears that with four other votes for overturning a key part of the act, Section 5, which relies on a combination of history and recent bad behavior to designate certain states and jurisdictions as having to get pre-clearance from the Department of Justice or from a federal court before they, say, abruptly change voting hours or redraw districts or change voter ID requirements. Now, when you think about the issue that Trump is banging away at about he would have won the popular vote by 3 to 5 million votes, except illegal people voted, and demanding an investigation. Those investigations are going to be against people in black communities. And you have Scalia, who Gorsuch, the new nominee, says was such a lion of the law, talking about voting rights as a racial entitlement. I mean, what does that say to you about where this is going?
Yeah, well, and it was a vicious move by Scalia, too. He made the point about voting because Congress had voted to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act on the anniversary there. And it had seemed like it was this, you know, moment of unity. I think even Jeff Sessions voted for it, you know, and then right away, the Supreme Court comes in and guts it by eliminating the preclearance decision. So almost sort of like a gut blow to the entire remembrance of the civil rights movement and, you know, to some degree, the institutionalization of that piece. And it certainly does not bode well. I mean, certainly this has been a huge issue for the courts. You already have John Roberts, who's the Chief Justice, who has been a big opponent of voting rights. And when you talk about investigating these voters using this cross-check system where we know, I think it's like one out of every four names was not an actual match, but it's tens of millions of people. It's going to be black people. What does that entail? Is it the police going to people's houses? Is it investigations into taxes and voting records and moving and cars? I mean, who knows what all it looks like? And I think that's sort of the scope of it, the unknown scope of it, is a very, certainly dangerous, at least it has the potential to be very dangerous.
Zach, well, if you're a professor at George Washington University, you are a civil liberties lawyer, you're a constitutional rights attorney. When you look at this Supreme Court, the way it's shaping up, and of course, Donald Trump has four more years, there could be numerous other vacancies, what are we looking at?
Well, I think your reference to the Voting Rights Act decision is really key, and it helps to show what a lie it is when we hear both Trump, Gorsuch, and all of his defenders talk about the role of the justice as being someone who will impartially call the shots, will apply the law, will look to original intent, which all sounds okay in a sense. But first of all, you can't do that because the main debates and conversations and challenges to rights that we're having right now have to do with what is the liberty that the Constitution protects. And this is the literal word in the constitutional text. Somebody's got to decide what liberty means. And then even when you look to the debate over the originalists, is they say, well, the word liberty therefore means what it meant when the law was enacted. If we're talking about Congress or if we're talking about the Constitution, the word liberty means what it meant in 1868 when the 14th Amendment was passed. But the Voting Rights Act, clearly the original intent of the radical Republican Congress was to dramatically alter the power of the states and to allow the federal government to protect the rights of newly freed slaves. And to say that you're an originalist, but you don't think the 15th Amendment allows the federal government to protect voting rights of African Americans in this country is patently absurd. And so, but that's the kind of thing that we're going to see. People coming forward, laying claim to nice-sounding, objective terminology and ideology that will maybe get some easily fooled liberals to say we should support them, when in fact what we're looking at is a radical right-wing approach to the Constitution and constitutional rights.
I know when Professor Wolf was talking about the radical Republicans, people would probably think he's talking about radical conservative Republicans, but he was actually talking about radical progressive Republicans after 1865, after the Civil War, when the possibility, the prospect of black voting and black citizenship for freed enslaved people following the Civil War became the issue. I so agree with him. The whole idea of the originalists and in terms of interpreting the Constitution, walk us through that a little bit and why that's inherently flawed, inherently against sort of human justice and decency.
Well, I mean, just this idea that somehow that is not a part of, I mean, when you talk about, just going back to thinking about the 15th Amendment, just thinking about the expansion of voting rights and access, full access of citizenship to formerly held slaves at that period of time, that is the cornerstone of basically this democracy, right? Being able to access and be active and involved in the process. So that's just an extension of a right that already existed and was making it afforded to all based on, at that time, males had the right to vote. But that is not like something extra or additional or, I mean, it's just ludicrous the way the arguments are now made that somehow it's entitlement, like you mentioned earlier, that somehow it is something that's being extra or put upon when there was a concerted effort to actually deprive and repress that right, that or the ability to access that right. We saw like great gains during the period of Reconstruction in the South in particular, where, you know, we had, you know, black elected officials and things of that nature. But as soon as there was no longer that effort by the federal government to enforce and to ensure that newly freed slaves and black Americans had the right to vote, to engage in the process, we saw, you know, that completely recede. So to have this argument, you know, now we had the long period of Jim Crow after that. So to have that argument now, given the history, and as we see, as soon as that case was decided in 2013, we saw several states pass very restrictive provisions pertaining to voting rights and access that disproportionately affected black. And when we look at Arizona, also Latino people, and make it that frustrate the ability to participate in the process, to exercise the right to vote. I mean, that's a fundamental right. And to have it frustrated in this manner, and then to hear, you know, noted legal scholars who talk about how this is so important and originalism, but yet they're not willing to actually enforce rights and make sure that people have equal access. It's very hypocritical and problematic.
Noah, we're going to have to go for a break in 1 minute, but let's start this discussion because what's on a lot of people's minds, I would say everyone, again, people who believe in justice, is whether the next Trump Supreme Court will overturn Roe v. Wade, the decision in 1973 that gave women the legal right to abortion. Where does Gorsuch stand? Where does this court stand? Where is this going?
Where we're going in terms of Roe v. Wade is going to be, I mean, I think everyone's going to hold their breath to see exactly how this is going to go down. I know Gorsuch is not the worst person that he could have picked on this topic, but at the same time, I mean, as someone who prides himself on basically being the new Scalia, or even I saw on a chart that he's actually considered by some even to be more right of Scalia, it's going to definitely come down to, you know, that swing vote, I think, in terms of where we stand in terms of at what portion, if any portion of Roe v. Wade definitely stands in the balance, you know, once the next case comes back up.
Okay, that's the voice of Anoa Chenga. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking about the selection by Donald Trump of Neil Gorsuch as the next Supreme Court, or at least the Supreme Court nominee. We'll see what happens. We're talking with Anoa Chenga, activist and lawyer and the host of the weekly radio show, The Way with Anoa. We're talking to her from Georgia, from Atlanta. We're also talking with Professor Zachary Wolfe. He is a lawyer, activist, and a professor at George Washington University. And we're speaking with Eugene Puryear. He is the show host of By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik. Eugene, the point that Donald Trump was making at the beginning of his press conference, where the stage-managed event, there was so much suspense. It was, again, like The Apprentice, who's going to get fired, who's going to get selected, who's going to wear the tiara out. One of the things that Trump said was, I'm a man of my word, and I'm sticking to my word. I'm going to show that I'm a man of my word. But his words have actually changed a great deal over time. At sometimes he was pro-choice. Then he became the candidate of the Republican Party, which is far right, and then he's now against choice. He said women should be punished for having abortions during the campaign. Now, I don't think Trump actually cares about abortion rights at all, or many of the other things that he's talking about. He's placating his ultra-right-wing base. But what's going to happen with this court on abortion rights? Because it seems such a fundamental issue, and you have already in the country many states, perhaps half the states in the country, have enacted laws that make it virtually impossible already for women to get abortions. They have, certainly for working class and poor women. In the big urban areas that vote Democrat, that are blue, are part of blue states, people may not feel the pressure of abortion rights, but Roe v. Wade being overturned, or the possibility of it being overturned, that could be such a phenomenally significant and historical thing that we could see, again, millions of people in the streets, because even in the last days, hundreds of thousands of people have been in the streets about at the inauguration, the day after the inauguration at the Women's March, at the airports and in cities, after the executive order that banned people from seven countries. We could be on the eve of a new mass movement, and Roe v. Wade and women's rights could become like the catalyst.
No, I think that that is certainly possible. I think that it's important that you mention the trap laws, the many laws that are being passed. I mean, really almost like a Jim Crow system for a woman's right to choose in this country at this stage in the game. And you think about sort of the reverse of that in different pro-abortion laws, sort of creating the context for Roe to arise in the first place, that sort of uncertainty of laws in all these different states. It just makes you seem to think that the thing is coming to some sort of denouement. I mean, you know, he's never ruled on this issue, so it's tough to say, but he did write a book about euthanasia, assisted suicide, and said it was wrong, and, you know, talked a lot about the right to life. But, you know, Roe is not just about that. I mean, you know, certainly I'm sure Professor Wolf, and I know I can say this, it's about, you know, the 14th Amendment, but nevertheless, who knows? I mean, like, maybe he will be more like Trump. Who doesn't know? I agree with you. I don't think it's Trump's main issue. But nevertheless, it does seem like this is coming to a head. It does seem like there's a very good chance, given, you know, the fact that he's against euthanasia, that he will be against Roe v. Wade. And I do think that given the size of the women's marches in America and around the world, seeing what happened in the Muslim ban, and not just in the United States. I mean, tens of thousands of people in the streets in London a couple of days ago. Coming up on Saturday, it's going to be another big protest there. Got world leaders speaking out against Trump. I mean, it really is an unbelievable sort of grassroots uprising that seems to be happening across a lot of different issues. And certainly, it would be sort of an intense provocation, I think, after this mass rising of women in the wake of the inauguration to then have this be an attack. But it seems like it's going to happen. I mean, that's a key piece of what the right is trying to do right now.
Neil Gorsuch, Professor Wolf, did participate in the Hobby Lobby decision. That wasn't abortion per se, but it's a gateway decision because it's about religion and the primacy of religion versus fundamental rights of women.
That's right. And the earlier announcements of his choices to lead cabinet agencies appeared to be an endorsement of a right-wing evangelical Christian view of how the government should relate to claims of religious rights. And the nominee for the Supreme Court has definitely taken that position really to an extreme. He wrote a concurrence in the Hobby Lobby decision at the Tenth Circuit level, where he wrote separately to emphasize that it was really up to the religion to decide what religious practices were core to its belief. This all comes down to there should be certainly an accommodation of religious belief and religious practices in our law. The Constitution should protect that. Judges should protect that. But there has to be some identification of what is a reasonable demand, what is a reasonable practice that the law needs to see as being your right. And he is going out of his way in order to say that it's not for judges to decide that. If someone says my religion demands that I be allowed to have this practice, that should be at the end of it.
But let's go over for the audience what the facts are of the Hobby Lobby case.
Sorry, yes. This is the contraceptive mandate, the requirement that employers who are providing health care, the health care package includes contraception coverage. And Hobby Lobby was saying that they objected to that they should not have to provide healthcare package that included contraception coverage. There was then a later case, the Little Sisters of the Poor case, that objected even further, saying that the response to the Hobby Lobby ruling was the federal government said, okay, then you don't have to provide it, but tell us that you're not providing it, and the federal government will pay for the contraceptive coverage portion of the healthcare package. Little Sisters of the Poor said, we can't even do that because that would make us complicit. And he, in that case, judge on that case as well, emphasize in his decision that it was not for the government to decide whether this was too much of an imposition or a reasonable imposition on religious beliefs. If the religious practitioners say this is too much, then we should just accept their word for that. There should not be any kind of independent evaluation.
So women who would, according to the Affordable Health Care Act, the health care that they pay for or that they and their employer pay for or that their employer pays for, they're entitled for contraception, for birth control. But this company, which is a fairly big company, I mean, Hobby Lobby's a craft store, it's a chain store. They said, well, we don't want to provide women with any ability to get contraception through the Affordable Health Care Act that is mandated. And so they went to court and they won.
That's right.
And Gorsuch help them win.
That's right.
So he's saying the boss's religious faith, which dictates that women should not have contraception, overrules the right of women to have something that is mandated as part of their health care.
Right. And beyond that, any time an employer or anyone says that this is in violation of my religious rights and is a major burden on my religious practices, that the court should not inquire any further. They shouldn't say, well, isn't there a way to respect people's rights notwithstanding your religious objections?
Zachary Wolf, I want to just stay with you for a quick second. Now, this is being applied to women and to reproductive rights, but it could be applied to gay people, to lesbian, gay, bi, transgender people. If somebody says, I'm against homosexuality, I'm against homosexuals, I'm against gay people, it's my religious belief, can they thus, using the same logic, deny them service? Can they? Can those companies deny them service? What about if they don't like black people?
That's right. And when Kim Davis says, I can't even sign the marriage certificate because that's against my rights, Judge Gorsuch, I believe, would not allow for any kind of response to that, to say, come on, you're just signing a government document. Everyone knows it's a government document. It's not your core religious practice. He would say, if she says it's a core religious practice, then that's the end of it. The court shouldn't second guess that.
Wow, I know. Jump in on that. I mean, it's very far-reaching once you get into the weeds, and well, not even the weeds, just the big picture of what these kind of rulings mean. And again, of course, it's about bosses. It's about employers, because they're the ones who are the dispensers of healthcare plans, and thus the boss gets to decide whether female workers have certain rights. And of course, this will be, if applied to other classes or groups of people, the same logic would prevail. Religion dominates.
Well, I mean, this is the whole problem with these religious freedom conversations anyway, right? There's this argument that, you know, somehow there's something that somebody else is doing in their own personal lives and their own personal choices is infringing upon my religious freedom, when in fact, really, we have people who are putting their religious preferences or ideologies upon other people. In this instance, we're talking about the Hobby Lobby case and the ability to make contraception available to those who seek it or whatever the case may be. We're saying that because we don't believe in contraception, allegedly, even though these same there were issues with Hobby Lobby, I think with, I don't know if it was the, I can't remember all the facts, if it was the insurance company made available for Viagra or if they were investing in their 401k in companies that dealt with Viagra. It was something like that that had something to do with Viagra. And they're often with these, when you talk about the contraception issue, there's often a lot of hypocrisy in terms of they'll be silent on issues of like Viagra or things like that. But then there's this hyper focus on women's ability to access contraception and even gynecological services in some instances. I mean, even when we see this whole we must defund Planned Parenthood movement, I mean, that's when we're really talking about attacking women's health issues, not so much, you know, people's alleged issue with abortion, but really actual like services that help low income women in terms of screenings and all types of stuff. So it's really interesting. We talk about people's right to we talk about free exercise. I mean, we're also talking about my right to not be put upon by someone else's, you know, religious precepts and beliefs. And I mean, we have to wonder, can we maintain civil society and actually engaging in things with massive amounts of people if any particular person can say, well, this infringes upon my religious practice, without any type of established, like acceptable, like realm, like anyone, like Satan, like this opens the door for Satanists to say, well, you know, my religious practice says I can do X, Y, and Z, and you're infringing upon that. Like, where do we actually draw the line with that type of rhetoric and notion?
Eugene Bannon, Steve Bannon, who is the national security advisor, the New York Times had an editorial entitled President Bannon ? And it had a graphic image of part of Donald Trump's face and part of Steve Bannon's face. He's heavy into the whole concept of American capitalism being based on Judeo-Christian principles, largely Christian principles. He made that clear in a speech in the Vatican in 2012. This is turning out to be a pretty hard right, very hard right administration, almost on all fronts. Perhaps they want to improve relations with Russia. So some anti-war people think that's a welcome thing, because of course it is. It was very dangerous as relations between the U.S. and Russia turned south, and as confrontation became the watchword, and as the Democrats were just beating up on the Russians constantly and making Trump out as the Manchurian candidate of Vladimir Putin, all that kind of witch hunting stuff was so repellent. But aside from his position on Russia, when you look at this administration, and of course, the judges are going to be political appointees of this administration and thus likely to ratify the positions of this administration. You have abortion rights. You have voting rights. You have the end of regulations that protect labor, the end of regulations that protect environment. I mean, this is a hard right, pro sort of unrestrained capitalist government that's shaping up. And it looks to me like the court is trying to be made into its own image, and it might be given the number of vacancies that might come up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly true. I mean, I think this, to a large degree, it's almost like a 19th century, at least, that and pre kind of worldview in terms of the relationship between power and people, and certainly the interpretations of, you know, who has what rights. And I think certainly it's, and I think this is a growing worldwide phenomenon to some degree, sort of a traditionalist, Christian-based, right-wing capitalist culture that because of its sort of Christian, Judeo-Christian roots, has the ability to take on certain kind of populist elements along with the, unfortunately, the better part of the gospel. So, you know, to cynically use them. So nevertheless, I think that it's very clear that they intend to move forward very aggressively on basically what they said they were going to do. I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier that Trump said women should be punished for having an abortion. I mean, Mike Pence, as vice president, tried to put a woman in jail for having an abortion. So there you go. So I absolutely think that, you know, Steve Bannon is someone who ideologically perhaps maybe is the most coherent of all the people, and thus is drawing, you know, sort of the president comparisons and things like that, and sort of the Svengali thing. I mean, Karl Rove, but on steroids. But I think it's important, though, that we also don't lose sight of the fact that, I mean, all of these people are bad, and a lot of them. Jeff Sessions has his own history of very similar sort of ideas and ranting against globalists and things like that. The guy Stephen Miller, the policy guy who's in the White House now, who was under Sessions, who even really knows what Jared Kushner's agenda is. So there's a lot of kind of Rasputin-ish kind of figures. I mean, it's almost like Trump's administration is a little bit like a pirate ship, you know what I mean? And he's just sort of taken on all these various dissident capitalist strains and welded them into a little bit of something with the help of Bannon and a few of these other people.
Rogue capitalists, right-wing ideologues, oligarchs, generals. It's not pretty. We've been talking, and we'll continue to talk, with Anoa Chenga, Professor Zachary Wolf, and Eugene Puryear. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're joined from Atlanta by Anoa Chenga, activist, lawyer, and the host of the weekly radio show The Way with Anoa, as well as in studio by Professor Zachary Wolf, a lawyer activist. He teaches at George Washington University. And by Eugene Puryear, he's the show host of By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik. Zachary Wolf, you've been following the Supreme Court closely. You're here in Washington, D.C. The Supreme Court is here in Washington, D.C. I want to talk about what the role of the court is in politics, because the court, since the Marbury versus Madison decision, which I believe is in 1803, where the court, that's when the court decided that it was the Supreme Court, right? That they could overturn legislative decisions. Anyway, we don't have to go on to the Marbury versus Madison. It was 214 years ago. But that's when the Supreme Court became really supreme. But I want to talk about the intersection or interconnectedness between politics, political trends, the political climate, mass movements, and the decisions by this Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is 9 individuals. They're not elected. They're appointed. They can make decisions that have huge, far-reaching consequences. We have, for instance, the Dred Scott decision, Plessy versus Ferguson. Those were the courts ruling that the law of the land was in the interest, really, of the slave-owning class or those who wanted to end, eliminate, eviscerate black freedom in any form. Talk about how the courts are really not some sort of abstract legal jurisprudence group that lives in a bubble, but are part of society.
Well, that's right. And for the last generation, we've had an image of the Supreme Court as an institution that can protect individual rights. But the truth is, the vast majority of the history of the court has been the opposite of that. The vast majority of the history of the court has been undermining individual rights. Plessy versus Ferguson was a white supremacist Supreme Court that was intent on undoing Reconstruction and succeeded in doing so for almost 100 years. There was an era known as the Lochner era where the Supreme Court was saying that laws against child labor and requiring a minimum wage and overtime benefits was in violation of the right of the employer to contract as freely as he desired and was striking down all those laws. So we certainly have a long history of an activist Supreme Court on the side of big money interests and white supremacy. The decision on Gorsuch and the celebration of textualism and original intent and passively deciding on what the terms of the Constitution means is also in stark rebuke and attack on the alternative image of the living Constitution, which Justice Kennedy's opinion in Obergefell, the gay marriage decision, really laid out this idea that the Constitution says we are to protect liberty, the court's job is to protect liberty. What liberty means is something that evolves with time, that evolves in response to social movements and in response to mass protest. And this is a society as a whole that's trying to figure out what does liberty mean? And at some point, it will be the court's job to say, we now recognize that our earlier understanding of all that what liberty meant was restricted, and we need to have a broader view of what kinds of individual rights are respected by the Constitution. To say that we are now putting in someone who is an originalist and won't bring in his views, we know he'll bring in his views when it works for him, is really a direct response to that. An attack on that view of the Constitution is something that's not set in stone for the views of folks from 100 years ago, but it's something that is required to be updated. In fact, was originally intended to be updated, right? That whatever we think about the founders and the drafters, they weren't stupid. They knew that words like liberty was not a precise word. And so I think there's a strong argument that true adherence to the original intent means the living Constitution, recognition that we have words like this so that we can have a social movement that changes our understanding of that. So that's the sort of larger ideological and doctrinal conversation that's happening and struggle that's happening. There's also the practicality of it, that the op-eds coming out in favor of the choice of Gorsuch on the morning of the announcement, one of the reasons that that was being endorsed was that he clerked under Justice Kennedy. And Justice Kennedy is, in many, many cases, the swing vote, the deciding fifth vote. And so the hope was that even though he's clearly to the right of Justice Kennedy, that he would sometimes be able to move him over to vote with the conservatives on the court.
Yes, it seems to me that according to those op-eds, that so-called liberals are always looking for some hope somewhere other than the actual vigorous, vibrant struggle of the people, always holding out hope. Here you had, Noah Chenga, you had Sally Yates, the acting attorney general, was saying that, you know, Donald Trump's executive order banning people from seven countries was not legal because it was based on discrimination. Because he had said, according to her logic, that in the campaign that he was going to ban Muslims. Now, she was fired immediately by Trump. And now Jeff Sessions is coming up for the final confirmation hearings in the Senate. And I don't hear from the so-called liberals, and including the mainstream media like CNN, this big, angry thing about what just happened to Sally Yates. Not that I'm a defender of all things that Sally Yates did, but I mean, this is sort of a real Saturday night massacre type thing where the president fires the attorney general because the attorney general says the president's not acting legally. Where's the struggle? I mean, how are the liberals going to stand up to Jeff Sessions? Because obviously we know Sessions is to the right of Gorsuch. He is far to the right, even of Trump's real true beliefs in terms of his ideas about immigrants and his ideas about black people.
Thinking about, like, are we going to see this real, like, massive, like, uprising or movement? I mean, there is a lot of talk about what people are going to do. And there was initial outrage, at least in terms of people expressing outrage when Sally Yates was fired. But, you know, a lot of the response I've seen from various people has just been like, okay, well, that was kind of expected because, you know, she's an Obama holdover and his ego and, you know, other different things. It's funny because I've seen shared, what was it, a clip from Senator Sessions saying to her during her own confirmation that, you know, you are going to have to tell the president no. Do you get that? And it's so funny that now we're in this position where she has done that and she's been dismissed. And we have basically Jeff Sessions, who, you know, not only agrees with, you know, this Muslim ban, but has, as you said, all these other abhorrent views about women, about Black people, about LGBTQ folks. I mean, there's just so much so wrong. And so people I've seen, and let's see how quickly this mobilizes and actually takes on, that a vote for Sessions is, since the Muslim ban is something that just happened, and that so many people like, you know, John McCain, there's so many, you know, leading Republican senators who have made statements against it. It's like, okay, you're against it. It's so awful. Will you take a stand on Jeff Sessions? Now, how far Democrats actually push that, I don't know, because Democrats seem to operate on this thing about, you know, they don't like to use too much of their political capital in any one situation unless they can definitely win. And, you know, there's talk about possibly putting up a fight against the Supreme Court nomination. So is there going to be a trade-off? Are they going to back off of the Supreme Court nominee and really push hard against Sessions? I mean, Sessions, we've seen that there's been, like, in some cases, little reluctance to really challenge any of the nominees for cabinet position, the cabinet nominees, because of whatever, you know, rationalization has gone down. I mean, because these are people who get to be in these positions at the moment, and we do actually need them to. I mean, I understand the need to be strategic, but at the same time, I mean, if we're talking all this great big talk and wonderful talking points during press conference about resisting Trump and it's so awful, I mean, actually put your action where your mouth is. But will we actually see that? I'm not too confident. It just, I guess it depends upon which one is more valuable. Is it more valuable to have possibly a different or even worse Supreme Court pick? You know, do we frustrate that process for however long as possible? Or do we, you know, put it in terms of, you know, opposing Sessions? There has been some opposition, you know, particularly when there is the back and forth about things with John Lewis, but I don't really see it coalescing into anything from mainstream Democratic leadership, anything really actionable on a consistent and sustainable basis. We see a lot of that coming from grassroots networks, obviously, more so than anything else.
Eugene Perrier, I agree with Anoa. I mean, it seems to me to be very feeble. Obviously, the Democratic Party leadership could put up a real fight because people in the country, the majority of the people in the country, reject Donald Trump's positions. He only won about 25% of the vote. Hillary Clinton got a little bit more, but more. But certainly 25% of the electorate is not like a huge big mandate, even if Trump calls it a great landslide. But the thing that's happening is that the Democratic Party leadership has a completely different orientation towards fighting the right than the right has about fighting even the most moderate, mild, not radical positions of the Democrats. They wouldn't be doing, as Anoa is aptly and correctly describing, the liberals trying to figure out which battle to fight. Should it be Sessions or should it be Gorsuch or this or that? They said, we're against everything. We want Obama to fail. Everything that Obama tried, they put up fierce resistance. Merrick Garland, who is not a leftist at all, they just said, no, we're not going to allow his nomination to go through for the next year. Let the masses, let the people decide, which is unprecedented, really. They just opposed Obama no matter what. And even though they don't represent the majority opinion, they keep winning because of that sort of opposition. But the mealy-mouthed, decrepit, bankrupt liberals who say that they're against Trump and against his reactionary policies, they always find some reason after they have a press conference or show up opportunistically to speak at a demo, some reason to find a way back. In other words, to not really fight.
Yeah, well, I think that the reality is the Democratic leadership, to some degree, I think they don't know how to fight. I mean, if you look at what happened in the Obama administration, I mean, the entire sort of orientation towards the establishment section of the Democrats was towards conciliation with the Republicans and really the maintenance of the capitalist system. That was sort of their whole point was, come on, we're giving you all this stuff. Like, let's just make stuff happen. You know, we need to do these things for the quote unquote good of the country. But, you know, let's remember the business roundtable, all these sorts of, a lot of these big business lobbies were mainly supporting Obama's agenda in sort of the broad strokes, although they're certainly playing both sides of the fence. So ultimately, I think the Democrats now are in a situation where they're afraid to not to go into full opposition against Trump because they don't want to be painted as obstructionists, because the sort of whole basis is that they know how to manage capitalism in a way that can sort of ameliorate the concerns of many different people about the anxieties of their life due to the negativity, the exploitative and oppressive nature of the system, but also actually get things done, while the Republicans have sort of an institutional mandate in a capitalist system to make sure things never go beyond a certain point, and that sort of attack dog mentality is put in. So I think it's actually relevant to the positioning they have and the expression of the different types of rule that I think a corporate financial elite in this country has, that I think affects their ability to fight. And so the base of the Democrats, which is the people they're trying to ameliorate, the downtrodden people, if you will, are so far ahead of the leaders, and the leaders don't know what to do. They're showing up at these airport protests. They're trying to speak. They're looking stupid because the customs officials won't talk to them. And I think it's just, to some degree, the ground they've staked out, trying to sort of play that middle ground between the rights of capital and the rights of people, as opposed to the Republicans who, you know, the role they play is just more of a straight out attack role. So, you know, I think that to some degree is behind it, but ultimately it means that the Democrats will do very little. And I think the question is, you know, are we in a period of political realignment here with certainly the Democrats and the Republicans with a lot of internal difficulties, I think is the question.
Professor Wolf, I want to go back to the theme that you were talking about that's emphasized over and over again, and by Gorsuch, the new nominee for Supreme Court, about originalism or the originalist justices. In other words, those who are going back to the original Constitution as opposed to the living Constitution that you talked about. Now, the original Constitution was passed in 1787. It was passed in secret. At that time, according to the Constitution, of course, women could not vote. Enslaved people were not citizens and could not vote. Enslaved people were described as three-fifths of a human being. Men, white men, without property could not vote. In other words, it was a little club of aristocrats who were the revolutionaries who had overthrown British colonialism. And then since then, the U.S. uses this language of American exceptionalism. We're great. We're the city on the hill. And we are the rule of law. In other words, not humans, not people, not arbitrary, capricious individuals who have power and are manipulating things. It's law itself, a legal playing field. There's no top or no bottom on this ladder of law. It's for all. And yet, as we go back and as we are going into this obviously contentious period where women's rights, affirmative action, voting rights, so much workers' rights are up for grabs right now with the new Supreme Court, it's useful to just go back and remember that the Supreme Court made it all right and legal to segregate public transportation, for instance. And it was only when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat, and only when the people in Montgomery didn't ride the bus for 13 months, that they overturned public segregation. And then the courts acted. Then the court said the public segregation of public transportation in Alabama was not legal. And then all the other states in the South said, well, if they can do it in Alabama, we can do it. And then the courts changed. In other words, the people really can impact the courts if the people know that they have the power, if they use their power.
That's absolutely right. And there has to be an education for the justices on the Supreme Court, that there needs to be a better understanding of
education from the grassroots,
from the people, showing them what liberty means, showing them what a full understanding of equality means, and that has to be part of the change that comes to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. In other words, when you're talking about educating the Supreme Court, you're talking about having them feel the fire of the people on their feet. I think that's what we mean. We've been talking for the full hour about the new Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch. We've been talking with Anoa Chenga. She's an activist lawyer and the host of the weekly show, radio show, The Way with Anoa. We're talking with Professor Zachary Wolf. He teaches at George Washington University. And with Eugene P. per year, the host of By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.